Lake Effect continues on Milwaukee Public Radio. I'm Bonnie North.
And I'm Audrey Nowakowski. Just over a quarter century ago, Milwaukee native Steve Wallace started a chocolate company. It's not one of those huge players on the scene, nor is it a small boutique that makes truffles. Its greatest significance is that it makes chocolate bars in the African nation of Ghana, where cocoa beans are grown. And practically no one else has ever done that.
The 26-year journey has not always been easy or straightforward, and in fact started with a journey Wallace took to Ghana as a high schooler. He chronicles that first journey and the path that led to the creation of his company, Omanhini, in a new memoir called Obruni and the Chocolate Factory. Steve Wallace explained to Lake Effect's Mitch Tyke why the time was right to look back.
I think it was a time of reflection after 26 years, and I thought about the journey I had gone on, and people were asking about it. And I think on some sort of deep psychological level, there were things I needed to get off my chest and things that I wanted to talk about. And I felt very privileged that I'd been on this journey. I was part of Ghana back when it was under military dictatorships. And now Ghana is one of the longest lasting and most stable democracies on the African continent. So I was sort of an unwilling eyewitness to this emergence from what they call the lost decades of coup after coup in Ghana.
Right, this is the time between the end of colonial rule and the beginning of democracy.
Right. And I found myself giving a speech at a university. And one of the lines I always have is, this is a long company story. This is not a fast company. We live in a fast company world. This is a story of a company that has grown over time. And I wanted to discuss the pleasures of doing a sort of a slow company. And I quipped that I thought this would make a better book or a screenplay than a company on some days because of the frustrations of trying to get all this off the ground.
Enjoying chocolate almost sounds like a metaphor for this. The idea of this being a slow company and, you know, wanting to enjoy chocolate over time rather than just wolfing it down.
Right. It's a slow, wonderful indulgence. And I looked at it that way. For all the times that I thought there was some frustrations and I wish we had been growing faster and larger, quicker, there were just some wonderful moments on the journey that I wanted to share. And it was like really enjoying a fine piece of chocolate.
We have spoken about the company in the past, but honestly, I don't remember how far we went back in its story or your story. Your own connection to Ghana goes all the way back to high school.
To 1978. I was a high school exchange student. I grew up in Milwaukee and in the neighborhood of Whitefish Bay, and I won this scholarship on the AFS program, and they sent me to a little town called Sunyani, Ghana. And there I had my host father, his three wives, and his 21 children. So I took my place as child number 22, soon to be 23 because one of the wives was pregnant. And for me, it was a transformational experience. And I spent the really rest of my life looking for an excuse to go back.
But for as positive as an experience as it was, you were still an outsider. You were, this is where the term Obruni from the title of the book comes in.
Obruni, that's correct. So Obruni is the Chui language word, and Chui is maybe the largest spoken of the indigenous languages in Ghana, and it's spoken by the Akan people or the Asantes or the Ashantes, often called. And it means white person. And it comes from the story was everyone has a day name. So you might be Kofi or Kwame. And Kwesi was the name of for Sunday. And the story goes that the first white person came to Ghana on a Sunday. So all white people are called Kwesi Obrunis, literally white person who came on a Sunday. And so from then on, every white person there is named Kwesi or Kwesi Bruni, and that's what I was called.
You also got off to kind of an auspicious start when you got off the plane by inadvertently doing something that that made you a little notorious, right?
Well, it was. And part of the reason I love going back to Ghana is all the years I've been going, and it's probably now close to 100 trips, I learned something new absolutely every time. And so I had this lingering mystery that had gone on over 30 years. And I mentioned it to a Ghanaian just about 2 years ago, and he solved it. So I got off the plane in 1978. There were only three of us that were exchange students to Ghana. So I was two young women and myself. Got off the plane. It was really hot. And I took my windbreaker off, and I stood on the stairway that they had wheeled up to the plane, and I tied my windbreaker around my waist. And a woman who was in charge of the program grabbed my waist. She had a clipboard, and she was angry. She ripped my coat off, and she wagged her finger at me, and she was furious. And this was my first 5 seconds in Ghana, and I had no idea what I had done. And all these years had sort of lingered, like there must have been something. And not too long ago, about 2 years ago, I mentioned this to a friend of mine who's Ghanaian. And he said, stand up and tell me what you did again. And I stood up, and I mimed putting my coat around my waist and tightening. And he said, oh, Stephen, that's too funny. He said, what you're doing is girding your loins. It's as if you were a warrior and you had the old traditional robes and you were readjusting them, and it means you're itching for a fight. So what I did in my first 5 seconds in Ghana as a 16-year-old back in 1978 was get off the plane, and I told the whole country I was itching for a fight. And at that moment, the one large newspaper happened to take a picture of us, and that was on the front page of the Ghanaian Times a day later, me telling all of Ghana that I was itching for a fight.
So flash forward 15 years or so, you had become a lawyer, then you'd gone to work for the family garment business. Realizing that Ghana had gotten under your skin those years before, when did that feeling go from just being a feeling to being this idea that you were going to start a chocolate company in a place where no chocolate manufacturing was going on?
I think it's in a moment of clarity, one of the few moments of clarity we all may get in a life. If I didn't start this when I did, which was at the age of 29, I was quite certain that I would regret it when I was 80. And the only thing I knew for sure was I didn't want to be 80 years old, look back and say, I missed the moment. And I loved Ghana. There was something so intriguing and compelling about it that I wanted to go back. I wanted to go back with some purpose.
With Ghana, but you were not theretofore a chocolate maker or a chocolate expert.
No. So when I looked at Ghana and I thought, how do I get this back in my life? And for me, it was like that wonderful book that's on the bookshelf and you keep going back every year or two to reread it. How do I get back to Ghana? And I looked at Ghana and they had really four main raw materials that I could sort of play with. One was, it used to be the Gold Coast. So there's gold, diamonds, bauxite, which is the mineral they make aluminum out of, and cocoa. So gold and diamonds were part of huge cartels. The aluminum business took billions of dollars in technical skills far beyond what I had. And then there was cocoa. And Ghana reputedly grows the finest cocoa beans in the world. They'll trade at a premium on the cocoa exchanges. And I grew up in a family of people who loved to cook. So for me, I was comfortable in the kitchen. I looked at cocoa as one of the only four raw materials that I maybe could play with. So for me, it wasn't so much about chocolate, but cocoa became the vehicle that brought me back to Ghana.
Why, to that point, was there no decent chocolate that was coming out of Ghana?
Well, I think it is probably goes back to the colonial legacy, which was various, going back to the Danes, the Portuguese, the British, and the French were all in West Africa, and they were there to extract things from the earth, whether it was the diamonds, the bauxite, the gold, or even the cocoa. And there was no even pause to consider processing them or adding value there. So they'd take the diamonds back to the Netherlands, for example, or Belgium. They do the diamond cutting there. They do the processing offshore. So there was never skills, and for generations, Ghana had just been a place that pulled things from the earth, gave them to someone. There was a ready market. They never had to market it. They never had to articulate a value proposition for why you should buy our gold or our cocoa or our bauxite. It just, there were off-takers. And as long as the economic sort of arbitrage was in their favor, they had buyers. And I think just historically, Ghana never had this tradition of adding value, and that was seemed regrettable to me.
Well, and at the time you were starting this company, one of the issues was government ownership of processing plants.
Right. So Ghana is a country that had a vertically integrated cocoa industry. So the government of Ghana had an agronomy station which produced all the seed stock that all the farmers had to use. And the only private piece of this were the cocoa farmers. So you had 750,000 individual cocoa farms, largely owned by women because it's a matrilineal society. So these woman, family-owned cocoa farms, they'd grow the cocoa, and the government had a monopoly that would buy every single bean back from the farmers at a guaranteed price. So if on January 1, they went to you and said it'll be $1,000 a metric ton, and at the end of the year, the world price was $500, you as a cocoa farmer got the $1,000, and the government would go into debt as a consequence. If the world price went to $3,000, for example, you would get a bonus. You'd get most of that back. The government would keep a little bit, but you'd get your base floor price, plus you'd get a bonus. So it was a nice system. And then another government monopoly would take those beans, they'd aggregate them, and then they'd take them to the London and the New York markets and sell them. And the theory was, as I understand it, that the government didn't want some of the largest multinational cocoa processors negotiating with individual cocoa farmers who had, you know, probably inferior market knowledge, or at least these big multinationals would have superior market knowledge and could out-negotiate these farmers. So the government set up this vertical cocoa monopoly really to keep outsiders out. And I was an outsider and I had to find my way in.
And over the course of this book, we learn about the various bureaucracies that you had to negotiate. And we might think of bureaucracy in government in this country, but it's an entirely different brand of bureaucracy, or at least it certainly was in the 1990s in Ghana.
Well, that's right. When I started this, 85% of all jobs were government jobs, either federal, state, local of some kind. So there was very little private industry. And friends of mine who grew up said they had no role models, which goes back to your previous question. They didn't have most of the 15% that weren't working for the government were largely cocoa farmers or other sorts of agriculture. So it's not as if you walked up, you know, woke up in Sunyani, walked down the main street and saw all these private, you know, the lawyer and the banker and the seamstress and the bakery and the all the people that might have owned their own businesses, an accountant, things like the dentist. This was so unusual. So there was no real cultural of private industry. So everybody worked for the government. And it was, for me, a lesson in how to negotiate big bureaucracies. And what they had was a proliferation of them. So not only did I deal with Cocoa Board, but there was a Ministry of Trade and Industry, a Ministry of Agriculture, a Ministry of Labor. And at any given time, all four or five of these ministries thought they had a say in what I was doing, so I had to make the rounds.
What would you hope that someone reading this story today gets out of it? Is there a lesson about history that is also applicable to what people might be dealing with as they think about or go about the business of starting business today?
Yes, I think one of the motivations for writing the book was I wanted to talk about globalism in a far richer and a far more nuanced sense. And I think right now, globalism has become shorthand for economic exploitation, both abroad as we search for ever cheaper labor at the expense of domestic U.S. jobs. And I think that sort of that truncating of the conversation doesn't do us any favors, because I think writ large and over the long term, international trade creates wealth. Economists, academics would support that. And so how do we begin in this country to articulate the merits of globalism? How can it be done right? How can it actually create value and not just take jobs from one country and give them to another? So I looked at this as a way of what could Wisconsin do? You know, what we have this wonderful packaging industry and papermaking industry. You can go back to the German immigration who brought this printing technology. And one of the printers I use still has printing presses from, I think, the 1930s or 40s that are beautifully maintained, these old German machines. And so, we need to print really beautiful labels. We have to have beautiful packaging to compete worldwide. So I tried to do what we could do best here in Wisconsin, which was recipe development, the trade craft, the legal work, the packaging. But we can't grow cocoa here in Wisconsin, and we never will be able to just due to the climate. So what is it that Ghana could do? What machinery could we get in Wisconsin and take to Ghana? And that's what I wanted to explain in this book and see if we could maybe be a prototype or an archetype for how globalism actually creates wealth and doesn't destroy it.
Well, it's a great story. And Steve Wallace, thanks so much for sharing it with us.
Oh, it's my pleasure. Thanks for having me, Mitch.
Steve Wallace is the founder and president of the Milwaukee and Ghana-based Omanhini Chocolate Company. His new book is called Obruni and the Chocolate Factory, an unlikely story of globalization and Ghana's first gourmet chocolate bar. And I'll talk about it next Tuesday at Boswell Book Company. Wallace spoke with Lake Effect's Mitch Tyke.